What's a world like without COVID-19? Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, and the Rascals wonder a little bit about that. It has something to do with what we're talking about on WGN Radio these days. By the way, the Rascals start with a house party in Chicago and end up somewhere near the White House. We appreciate you tuning in. Please do share this with your friends if you've got a question or comment. Just email John Williams at WGNradio.com. That's me. This edition of the Mincing Rascals, sponsored by the Joint Relief Institute. If you've got a bad knee, by golly, you should be going there. They are an essential business. They're open. And frankly, we so appreciate their support in bringing the Mincing Rascals to you. I'd like you to go there even if your knee doesn't hurt. Just have them give you some of that juice. It's really an amazing thing. Here's what they do. They use digital imaging. They see where your knee is compromised. They put a lubricant into that spot. They're expert at this. It's all they do. And yeah, they are an essential business, so they will see you safely. That first visit, by the way, is free, that exam. And they've got an insurance specialist to make sure you get the maximum coverage. You might not have to pay a nickel at all. Medicare patients, too. So let's get you maximum relief from your knee pain. And take that socially distanced walk now that the weather's going to get a little bit better. Good grief, could we use that? Visit jointreliefinstitute.com or call them up at 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Okay, here come your rascals. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2020. It's 1:40 in the afternoon, and hi, this is John Williams, and we're the Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record from WGN Radio's almost completely vacant offices in downtown Chicago and throughout Chicagoland.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
I'm Eric Zorn, the already really rocking columnist from the Tribune.
No, get that one. What's that one?
Oh, Jared Kushner said that the economy will be really rocking by July.
And I think you'll see by June, a lot of the country should be back to normal. And the hope is that by July, the country's really rocking again.
By the way, last week we opened this podcast with a lengthy discussion about the TV shows we're all watching. So much so that Steve Bertrand got fussy. In that same podcast, Steve wondered what it would be like if a radio station would just stop all COVID-19 talk altogether for a day, give everyone a break. We're about to find out if that's a good idea, because the host radio station here, WGN, is going to talk 24 hours virus-free outside of the newscasts tomorrow. So if you're listening to this segment after Friday, May 1st, go back and listen to the show podcast to get at least some of the segments coronavirus free.
So we'll still be doing the news of the in the newscast, but just the program hosts won't be doing any COVID topics.
It's going to be really interesting because it's such a big story.
The face Lisa's making right now.
I just don't know what you're going to do. You always give me a hard time about my faces. I'll try to play, you know, my poker face. I don't know how you'll do that. Weren't your callers? Yeah, bring it up. It is such a big deal. I'm not giving you a hard time. I think it's something cool to experiment with. But I'm just wondering, your callers are going to naturally go to this, right? The people who email in through Facebook and all that other stuff.
We've announced that we're going to do it, and I think they're anxious for it.
So on satellite radio, you know, the Hallmark Channel. Did I say this last week? Has their Christmas music channel up again?
Oh, really?
Running Christmas music?
Yeah, that's more. Right. That's creepy.
Yeah, I don't even like that during the regular.
No, I don't either.
Right.
And I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea, but I just wondered what it would be like, and so we're going to find out.
Eric, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that it's a really interesting idea for getting attention to the station. I think it's going to be really, really difficult because every story seems to circle back to this. It's just really, really hard to stay away from it. I don't think that I've had a column in the last 5 weeks that hasn't at least mentioned the coronavirus.
Right. Well, John's going to do a painting lesson for his listeners in 1.5 hour, so that'll be good.
Well, you could certainly talk about the accusations against Joe Biden, right?
Right.
That's a segment right there.
Yeah, hooray. Lucky me.
The thing is, like,
maybe what you got your friends for May Day. I mean, that's a big holiday in our house.
a lot of us have been squirreling away ideas and stories, you know. Unfortunately, that woman that got creamed by a line drive at Wrigley Field.
Oh, that's awful. Yeah.
A year or two ago has brought a lawsuit that's back in the news. And this isn't the Albert Almora Jr. one from last year. It's another one. Lady is seriously injured. She's still suffering from the consequence of it. She's suing the Cubs. Hey, there's 20 minutes. I'll tell you what else I'm thinking about doing. Fiona Apple's new album got a perfect 10 on Pitchfork site. There's that movie Bad Education, which is really good. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but
what is that? My wife was asking me about that.
It is so good. It's a true story of a few years ago when a superintendent of a school district in New York ripped him off. You know, they have these massive budgets, and he was skimming millions of dollars. And an enterprising young reporter for the student newspaper took him down.
Wow.
It's a very good show. Hugh Jackman is the superintendent. It's pretty good.
Right. I'm trying to ignore all the, a lot of these TV shows because I feel like it just plays into my, that FOMO thing. I'm skipping all these recommendations and just sort of trying to be zen about all of this.
All the things you're not watching.
Right. Because then it's just sort of like, I'm missing out on this. I already have that sort of in my regular life. Like, oh.
I think that's a great idea, Lisa, but you really should watch Succession. It's really good.
I know. I actually wrote that down because you told me that before.
Maybe you should go clubbing to some of those house parties that are rocking Chicago right now.
Well, there was a discussion in my friend group about sort of who would we have been back in our 20s. Would we have been cautious or would we have been folks who had a little rager? And I'm just not sure. I'm not sure. No, nobody came to any good conclusion, which kind of scares me that I might have been on the rager side.
What I'm bringing up is the story of that house party where the original report said upwards of 1,000 people. Yeah. There weren't 1,000 people there, but I saw 50 in one screenshot, and there may have been hundreds at a house party in Chicago, which is ironically held in the home of a Chicago Fire Department commander.
And I'm going to get up at the jam if the police come. Hey! Good that it's not down at the coronavirus place of Avenue. Huh? You talking about get here, can't nobody else fit. We the smart ones. We stand away from that.
I guess the woman's son doesn't live with her, but he had the key, knew how to get in. So then he throws a party. I guess his mom wasn't there. She's a first responder, right? And he has hundreds of people jamming at his house. He said that he did it to honor a couple of his friends who were killed by gunfire in Chicago a couple of years ago. But he also said he didn't hear much about social distancing. He thought some of this virus stuff was a hoax. Evidently, he didn't realize that nobody's on the streets. So he just didn't seem to hear much about the virus, but now he knows better. And he's even going to do promotional videos to tell kids to pay attention.
You sound like you don't quite believe that. Is that right? Are you cynical about it? I'm not. I don't think I am. I think there are plenty of people who live in this city who have to go to work. They have to get on a bus. They are not lucky like I am. I'm staying home. I get to stay home and work. And after a while, I have to believe that even with the news of this, you know, social distancing stuff, that, okay, I still have to go to work. I have to get on a bus. I have to do this. I have to do that. And the impact, I think, of this thing lessens is it's less about sort of press conferences announcing who's passed away, how many more people are sick. And it becomes sort of, well, I'm still living my life. I'm still out here doing this thing. Yeah, it might be risky, but it feels less risky every day that I have to do it.
I don't know. You don't think that guy didn't notice that nobody else was on the bus?
Security. There are people on the bus.
But Lisa, I agree. People have to go to work, and John and I are in downtown, but you know, most of us are lucky that we don't have to do that. But even the ones who do are aware of what's going on. It's hard to believe that you're so out of touch that you don't know you're not supposed to have a house party.
I don't know if you guys read both the Tribune story and the Tribe story, the publication. I don't have a hard time believing that. These are young people who are saying, I don't watch the news because it's depressing. It's also sort of, we're living in this age of like video streaming where you don't sort of pause and go, ooh, the 10 o'clock news is on.
But I open up, every time I open up Instagram or Facebook, there's a COVID-19 ad across the top of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that they might be the 20-year-old ravers who think they're immune, but I have a hard time believing they aren't aware of it.
I had an interesting conversation with a friend whose grandmother lives in Calcutta, And she was talking to him about how surprised that she was that people in India, most of the urban service workers are from rural areas. So they all left the cities. They all migrated to rural India. And these are the poorest of the world's poor. And they are talking to each other about Italy and Spain, which his grandmother didn't even know that they knew about Italy and Spain, doing social distancing, wearing masks. These are people in the middle of nowhere, India,
right.
Dirt poor, you know, with like flip phones. So they know. And I think that's the point. Like, yeah, I think everybody's aware. Like everybody in Chicago is aware that this is going on. But it's also like young people exist to break rules. I'm surprised this isn't happening more. Like, was it good that they were shamed? Like, do you think it is happening? It's just being undercover.
Yeah. I absolutely think it's happening. And I think there is a lot to be learned in reading that tribe story about who makes up the media, what kind of news we're delivering. And it's something we all need to wake up to.
But it also happened, did it not, with a wedding party on the north side, which would have been older, more informed people, you would think, right? What, didn't the police break up a wedding party that moved out onto the streets?
You know, in a way, it almost doesn't matter what the motivation is. Like, was it indifference or ignorance? The point is, that's the problem for all of us. That Mayor Lori Lightfoot's got to figure out how to manage those people too. That's how hard their problem is.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of all of our problem, though. And again, I encourage everybody to read the Tribe article. It's all of our problem. It means that we need to cover news in a way that reaches all corners of our city. And that's what that revealed.
I almost don't know how you could have avoided if the guy said he did not know about social distancing very much. I don't know literally how you could have avoided that message. I also don't know what the Tribune or WGN radio is doing wrong to inform these people when they're willfully ignoring the news. God, we need to knock on their door.
Well, I mean, it's really
larger than that, and it's about consistently covering communities. If you read that article, there is a very pointed comment in there about how I don't watch the news because all it ever reflects are bad things about African Americans.
But is that true of African American radio stations, for instance? I mean, were they downplaying this? Because this virus has.
I don't know. Do you listen to it, Eric?
I don't. I don't. But I don't know if they have been stressing the fact that this virus has been particularly impacting the African American community, which I think one of the things that made this story, you know,
right,
rise up to this level of outrage, just to say, come on, it's your community, it's your mothers and fathers and grandparents and uncles and aunts who are going to be impacted when this virus spreads more because you're having these stupid parties.
Well, the zip code in which the party was being held is the most afflicted zip code in the city.
But I think at the same time, we're looking at a phenomenon that we're seeing also downstate among some of these more rural people who are protesting the lockdown, which is that they may not be seeing it in their immediate surroundings. Like, young people are not seeing this, you know, seeing COVID-19 hitting them as much as older people are seeing it. And they may look around their peer group and not see it. I know that when you talk about some of these downstate counties where you've had one death, no deaths, no cases, I think in some counties, no deaths.
No, I think there's still maybe six counties with not a single case.
Not a single case. So they're looking around saying, we've talked about this, I think, before, which is, you know, hey, my diner's closed down, my movie theater's closed down, my hardware store's closed down. Well, maybe not my hardware store, but, you know, a lot of these businesses are closed down. My pet groomer is closed down. I can't get my hair done. And I don't know anybody who's sick, and it's a bunch of these people in Chicago who are sick. And I think that this builds up a lot of pressure in people, and that may be part of what you're seeing in those houses.
The Republican delegation to Congress from Illinois sent the governor a letter today saying that we need to reopen in a phased way, in a regional way. And I think they have a point. I mean, John talked to Greg Batten from the Peoria radio earlier this week from The View down there.
Those of us who live downstate, we kind of feel like the little brother. Chicago is the big brother, cooler, got more money, does cooler things than us, and we're just trying to get by and do our thing, right? And so we're always comparing ourselves. But, you know, hey, we're a lot like Chicago. We're just smaller, except for right now. We don't want to be compared. We want to just go, hey, can we do our own thing? We would just like to be left alone. We have 69 cases in Peoria County and two deaths. Now, two deaths too many, 69 cases too many. But comparatively, we're doing great. And so it's on our minds, why can't we go do stuff? It's really starting to boil.
I don't think they're necessarily wrong. If there's not a single case or if there are very few cases, maybe we're going to have to let the gas up eventually. And why not do it regionally down there maybe first?
The point Lisa's making about a cynicism and distrust of institutions is often warranted. It's true for both the communities we're talking about on the West and South side and for a lot of rural communities in Illinois, going back years, decades, and generations for a number of reasons. And I think it's hard not to empathize with people who feel like they've been completely forgotten in terms of the economic effects of this, especially while they're seeing governors in Ohio, Minnesota, Colorado, all of these states that aren't, you know, hard red states with cogent, detailed reopening plans that are being done safely. And I thought Governor DeWine did a really good job of explaining how he's thinking about reopening, why he's reopening certain industries at certain times. He's kind of balancing number of employed with risk. And those are kind of the two spectrums that he's thinking about in phasing in the reopening. And when asked about it, Pritzker seems to just brush it off every time as kind of non-scientific babble, when in fact he's got peers, Democrat and Republican governors, that are pursuing these plans and giving details.
I find myself hoping that they're doing it right in Georgia, because if they are doing it right in Georgia, that would be great news for the economy. I mean, we all know we have to, as Steve says, take our foot off the gas on this lockdown. But you really worry that when you start opening up movie theaters and diners and so on, that you're going to cause another spike. And of course, in the long run, if everyone says, oh, Pritzker was overcautious, then maybe he'll keep the death toll down and things will be seen as the right move. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times. It listed 43 things we don't know about COVID-19. And it just went on and on about all the, we don't know about whether you can be reinfected again. We don't know about the all the exact modes of transmission. We don't know why it affects certain people certain ways. And it just goes on and on. And then so, like I said, we don't know whether Georgia's doing it right. And we hope that they are, but I wouldn't let anybody get too excited about any one approach.
You think these mixed messages are coming from, you know, we talked about this earlier. These mixed messages seem to be along partisan lines. Sometimes not. Sometimes sort of you have an elected leader talking out of both sides of the mouth there. Like, we're going to let up, but we don't know about this. And so all of these unknowns, you're sort of, you know, one mind that, well, if they don't know, shouldn't we all just hunker down? And other people are like, well, if they don't know, why are they telling me I have to stay home?
I've got two issues or two questions. One of the things is they say for phase one to come into fruition, you have to have 14 days of fewer cases reported, correct?
Consistently, so 14 days of falling numbers.
During that same time, we're ramping up the testing. So we'll never get to fewer cases if
we have
1,000 more.
Test fewer people.
So that's one question I have. The other question, and I got this through to the governor's press conference yesterday, but they didn't. I wasn't there to answer a follow-up or ask, so did they miss the point of it?
Steve Bertrand with WGN Radio. Possibly another question for Dr. Azike. Do you have data on what populations are making up the newly infected cases? We've been staying at home for several weeks, so are the new cases primarily essential workers, or are people who are staying at home still getting sick anyway?
Just to review how this virus is transmitted, if you have been home for, I don't know how many days now. If you have been home, the virus cannot come up de novo. Of course, we know that there are many people in our state that do have to leave the home, whether they're essential workers, and there are many from.
I want to know who's getting sick now. You know, we had over 1,000, those had 1,000 people yesterday. Question. So I want to know if there are people who are like John and I who are coming downtown to work, or if there are people who have been staying at their home. Yes, they're going to Walgreens. Yes, they're going to the grocery store. Who are the new cases? And Dr. Azike is sort of, not that she brushed it off. I just don't think you can't clarify it when you're texting in questions. But, you know, she said, well, people who are staying at home are still going out. I understand that's true. But are those people staying home still the ones getting sick? Or is it just the people who are driving the buses and making the food and things like that? I want to know the answer to that question.
Yeah. Well, we don't know how people get it. That's another thing that came up in this list of things we don't know, which is that we really don't know how it's transmitted. And there's this issue that's percolating around about whether anyone who gets COVID-19 can automatically be counted as someone who it's a workplace injury, as an on-the-job illness.
Workers' comp, yeah.
And we're for compensation purposes. And the truth is that they often don't know. I mean, we talked about a poll worker who got sick, and people said, well, he got sick working the poll. We don't know that he got sick at the poll. He might have picked up the virus getting gas from the gas pump on his way to the polls or some other day. But that's one of the things that's really maddening about this and frustrating, is we really don't know how people are getting it, except, I guess, in the case of nursing homes.
Pretty Steve obvious. And I come downtown every day, and I was wondering if maybe because we're more mobile, we might feel differently about this. I have this almost fatalistic attitude about it now. I think it's been 40 plus days now. I come downtown every day. I do the shopping for my family. When am I not going to get it, you know? And if I do, what will that be like? And it'll suck in a thousand ways. But in this scenario, I survive. But that's kind of what I think. If it happened to me tomorrow, I'd go, well, I had a good run. That's where my head is.
Wow.
Jeez.
Really?
Yeah.
No? You're kind of like a skydiver, right? It's like you're a skydive instructor, and every day you're putting on the people on your back, and then it just becomes rote at a certain point.
I think John has a joke about that.
You don't need a parachute to skydive once. You need a parachute to skydive twice. I'm not wishing it on me, and I'm not being irresponsible, but I do think, like you guys are saying, I wonder how people get it. Is it just random shopping? Is that how people are picking it up? Because if that's the case, is it going to the gas station? Is it coming downtown and opening a public door every day? If that's the case, how have I not gotten it yet?
Yeah. I suspect that, I mean, I'm sure they don't know how everyone gets it, but I bet they're not keeping that data, or they don't seem to be keeping that data of who is a stay at home and who's not.
And the other thing, John, is that you may have gotten it already and just been one of these people, one of the many people who get it and have no symptoms.
I want to go back to what you guys were talking about, at least I think Austin brought this up, about downstate maybe not entirely trusting the Chicagoland area. There's this disconnect between different parts of the state. And Eric, weren't you writing a little bit about how if we were going to cut Chicago or the collar counties off from the rest of the state, what would that look like and what would it mean? It's kind of weird, almost unfortunate for people south of Peoria that they do have to be part of Illinois in a way, because they so disagree with so much of what they have to live with. But they do benefit greatly, right, Eric? If they sawed off Chicago, they would be sorry for it in the long run.
Oh, yeah. In terms of the economic engine of the state, it's certainly the six-county area here. If you were to cut Illinois at I-80, and it would be one of the poorest rural states in the country, maybe the poorest rural state in the country. We send a lot of our tax money downstate.
The prison system, the universities, the research facilities, the state parks are largely funded by people who pay taxes in the six-county area.
So I know it's been a long time ago, but Illinois was, if not a red state, it was certainly, before there were red and blue, there were mixed states or not. They didn't give them the titles. And in the days of George Ryan and Jim Edgar and Jim Thompson and Pate Phillip, I mean, there were Republican leadership. What is it that's changed that they've lost so much power? I mean, are there that many more votes now in Chicago, or has the party moved away from the people who used to vote Republican?
I think you've seen generationally Republican strongholds like DuPage County. I think as you've seen more people move out of the city, people who are maybe a little more liberal, you've really seen those suburbs change, and you've also seen it become more diverse. With that diversity, more people of color, you're going to get more Democratic voters. And so you don't see that sort of suburban Republican definition anymore. If you look at sort of where Trump has won, you know, you're looking sort of a little bit farther downstate. That's a lot more conservative bend, because this has clearly become a Chicago versus the rest of Illinois thing. This is just the latest iteration of it. That's kind of where they're at. They said that it still goes back to the old days, people, you know, the 60s, you know, or earlier, when people were just downstate were ticked off that the Democratic machine in Chicago was running everything, that they had no voice. yes, they might have been a smaller percentage of the population, but they had no voice. They had no decision in matters. And that still is a thing. It still sort of rubs people the wrong way, even, you know, 50, 70. Right.
Okay, but wait, when I started in this business, there was a long-term Republican governor. Pate Phillip was the leader of the Senate. Lee Daniels was the leader of the House. And that was in the mid-80s or so.
Yeah.
Lee Daniels was like 2 years, right? I mean,
oh, yeah, but it was a great 2 years.
I think that's the unspoken deal was always that county and city jobs would go to the Democratic Party and the state patronage jobs would go to the Republican Party in Illinois. And Lisa's exactly right that the power balance has shifted because the suburban political makeup has changed. That's been the one big driving force. And then the second one is the map. They're politically drawn maps and they favor the incumbent party. So,
and speaking of that's part of it. And speaking of the map, it looks as though, I mean, there was still hope some people had that we would have a referendum in the fall ballot to change the way political maps are drawn. And it looks as though it's impossible now because this legislature is not going to be meeting. Right. The deadline is May 3rd, I think, to get a referendum passed, to get it on the ballot.
Right.
The legislature is not going to even be meeting till May 5th. So we're not going to have any more referenda on the ballot. I know that a lot of people thought that this might be the year for a remap referendum.
The most important issue that Illinoisans should vote on is whether the tax burden should go up. And nothing else,
or down if they're under a certain level,
or down by $6 if they make $12,400 a year.
You can order like a nice big sub sandwich for that $6.
Yeah, coffee.
Hold on a second. What's the subtext here? What are you guys talking about, Austin?
The graduated income tax.
I know, but I want them to say it.
The graduated income tax.
It's actually called the fair tax. It's very fair.
You'll notice, Austin, that I don't use that tendentious term.
No, I respect Eric a great deal for not using it.
Steve, I'm trying to bait them and you.
I know.
You answer the questions, it won't work.
We got to do a whole podcast on this.
I know. Someday we will.
Well, and also we should wait, and we wait until when people are actually thinking about something other than the virus to talk about it. I mean, I've been writing a couple of columns on it, but it's hard to get attention for it because people are.
Maybe we should be back here tomorrow. I hear WGN is going to have a non.
There you go.
There
you go, John. There's another topic.
There you go.
I want the world to be very forgiving of us if somebody just happens to be dialing across, going, "What are these people living in a fog? Don't they even know?" Just for one more second, though, entertain me on the downstate lawmaker who's suing JB. Mm-hmm. Does he have a point? Does he have much sympathy here? I mean, you guys talked briefly about the fact that there's not many of those cases down there, but it's weird, isn't it? He won the case for himself, so he can hit the ball over the net, but there can't be anybody on the other side.
I thought it was odd, the very specific focus on it only applying to him. Like, the nature of law is that the ruling applies to the plaintiff, but then there are consequences of that that are more far-reaching than just the ruling on the specific person in question. Darren Bailey filed this lawsuit saying that Governor Pritzker had this vast overreach on his executive order, the extension of his stay-at-home order. And you even saw folks in state legal officials. There was a memo that leaked that showed that there were, even within the state, some issues and concerns about not involving the legislature when doing these types of sweeping orders beyond 30 days. Should we revoke the stay-at-home order completely and let everybody run in the streets? No, I'm not advocating for that. You should involve the legislature in matters of statewide policy. Like, this is an emergency. But when does it become a long-term thing, you know, 30, 60, 90 days, where you want to get state lawmakers involved and have them approve or improve or change or reflect the needs of their constituents in these orders instead of just Pritzker doing it all himself?
And it wasn't just a guy who filed a lawsuit. The judge saw it his way. I mean, the judge looked at the law and ruled in his favor.
The law is not written to cover something like this exactly. And they talked, there are examples in the past where governors have declared emergencies for like floods, and they're 30-day emergencies, and then they just extend them because the flood is still there, the damage is still there, and nobody really cared because it's, you know, usually an emergency declaration means that we're shoveling aid at you and we're trying to help you out, so nobody's too concerned about what the impact of that declaration is. So the precedent in the law looks like the governor does kind of have the authority to say, well, it's a new emergency now. It looks like it's the same emergency, but it's a new emergency because it's in May. And so he's going to go to the Supreme Court. Pritzker is going to go to the Supreme Court with that argument. But I agree, though, in in part with what Austin seems to be saying, which is you can't really have a law that just allows the governor to declare a state of emergency forever without any oversight, that you do want to have some way of having at least the legislature come back and say, yeah, okay, keep going. And the legislature is not in session. So we're in this strange legal no man's land right now.
That is the question, though, that remains. The legislature is not in session. There doesn't seem to be a huge rush for either of the leaders, both, you know, Democrats in both chambers, to sort of figure out a way to meet. And I don't know how you would do it. It's much larger than city council. I would think that there would be sort of a big push to figure this out. If there was a will, there would be a way. I mean, sorry to be that corny, but it just seems like if there was some real political will there to gather and figure this out and make sure that oversight is there, they would do it. And they have.
But Lisa, they did so much last year in the legislative session. We really can't expect them to do much this year.
It's really productive.
Yeah.
What do you think about the fact, Lisa, that this is so I always think about this book, Don't Make No Waves, Don't Back No Losers. And it was like, you know, the daily slogan. The reason you don't meet as the legislature is you just make the governor wear the jacket for all this, and you don't have to have downstate Democrats on the record supporting a stay-at-home order. That would be my view of why this is happening, but I could be off base on that.
But none of this happens without sort of everybody sort of being all in, as they say. You know, I think that I do. I think there's probably a lot of these, you know, you just sit quiet and let things go. Hey, we didn't do this. The governor did. And I'm not picking on Pritzker, but all of these governors are sort of front and center on this. Right. I guess my point is sort of that they're ready-made answers. This is uncharted territory. And we just responded the best that we could. And nobody can really judge. I think sometimes we're caught flat-footed as journalists, even, because it's hard to know, okay, there's no precedent for even covering this stuff. So it's very difficult to sort of, you're trying to follow the money. You're trying to understand what's going on and making sure that you're being a watchdog and all of this. And that can be a difficult thing to do.
1 week ago today, I guess it was, the president made some news saying that medical doctors should look into using UV lights and disinfectants as a way to beat the virus.
We hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets in the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
And the next day, he virtually denied every part of that, leading me to conclude that, among other things, he's a really bad liar, because everything he the next day denied is categorically proven on the tape and on the White House transcript the day before.
At first, the White House spin was that it was taken out of context and he was talking to somebody else and not. And then he said he's talking to a reporter, and then he said that he was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
He's not a very good liar about this. I guess I believe Dr. Birx, who said that they got into a meeting and they got him kind of spun up in this meeting beforehand. And they're saying, well, there's evidence that UV light and do this and disinfectants can work on surfaces. And in his brain, it kind of got jumbled around in that you would use disinfectants. And he talked about injecting disinfectants into people. And it was a very strange thing. I don't quite understand why it is that he feels like he has to play a doctor at these meetings. What the country, I think, would like to see was him saying, I'm consulting with the medical experts. They feel like, you know, X, Y, and Z may be promising. Let's see. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But instead, he's like, he tries to talk up all these various formulations. Now, I guess it was, you know, hydroxychloroquine for a while, and And now it's remdesivir? Is that what how you say it?
Remdesivir, yeah.
Remdesivir. Now
which Fauci liked, but Fauci likes that too. So
Fauci likes that too, and that gave me some hope actually, because Fauci doesn't seem to be a guy who gets out over his skis that much. There might right. be some.
Course, I get mad at both of them, Eric, for not. Why didn't Birx? There was some pushback from Dr. Birx on Friday and Saturday after that Thursday.
You mean pushback on her?
Pushback on her because she didn't push back on the president. They're not going to fire her. And if they fire her, she'll find work. I mean, I don't know what these people have to lose.
I was reading something that they do want to be temperate, that they are temperate people. They want to be up there because they believe that they have a duty. I'm not taking their line. I'm just saying that they want to stay in place. They want to be a voice of reason and of expertise to the people. They feel a real public duty.
No, sure. But the other thing is they have not appeared with him at a briefing since. Now, maybe I think yesterday Dr. Fauci was at a Oval Office availability with the president, but there have only been a couple briefings, and I don't think they were at either of the briefings.
Soledad O'Brien had a pretty good tweet where she just reimagined what she would have said the next day, because that was a Thursday, Friday arc, and then that Sunday, they were all out on the Sunday shows, and Soledad O'Brien was sort of patching things, or Dr. Birx was patching things up.
I think the media is very slicey and dicey about how they put sentences together in order to create headlines. I think, we know from millennials and other studies that some people may only read the headlines, and if there's not a graphic, they're not going to look any further than that. And I think we have to be responsible about our headlines. I think often the reporting may be accurate in paragraph 3, 4, and 5, but I'm not sure how many people actually get to paragraph 3, 4, and 5.
And O'Brien said, here's what you should have said. And she called her a coward. I'm kind of on that page a little bit. I want these people to speak truth to power.
Why does she get the grief for it, though? Fauci isn't calling him on it either. He gets Brad Pitt playing him on SNL. It's baloney.
No, but Fauci has been more likely to be critical than she is. But I think she gets
the grief. When's the one time Fauci? God, I'm mad at all of you guys today. What's the matter with
you? Yeah, I'm mad at you too, John. Go ahead.
There was maybe not last weekend, but the weekend before, where Fauci gave a series of interviews where he was kind of direct about what he can say or can't say in front of the president. But I don't mean to diminish the. I think Birx took the heat because Birx was there that day, and then she was the one put out that weekend for all the Sunday shows.
Well, she was in the shot. They had looking mortified as he's talking to her about these crazy things. So then she's sitting there looking like, what am I going to say? This is batshit crazy. And then she has to go on the air on Sunday and kind of defend it. And they would ask her about it, and she would just say, I saw on some of the shows on Sunday, she'd say, like, well, what I'm really concerned about is how we're talking about, just trying to deflect.
Media's getting it wrong.
Because I do understand.
Yeah, I think she said, well, we're just looking forward at this.
Yeah, we're looking forward. We're not going to look back at the crazy stuff he says.
Yeah.
But, Camera 2 gets a Nobel Prize for me, though. I didn't know they had some cameras. And doggone it, the zoom in on that thing was money. That was amazing. By the way, Eric, you are labeled on the screen here as already really rocking columnist. That's your reference to Jared Kushner. Why was that resonating with you this week? See you, Steve Bertrand.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Steve.
And we're about to lose Lisa, too, by the way. And Lisa, I just want to apologize in advance for being hostile to you. I love you, and you're super talented and smart.
I'm used to it.
I'm going to go back and read that article, by the way.
Okay. I'm still here for a couple of minutes, unless you want me to bow out now.
No, hang in there.
So Jared Kushner went on Fox News the other day, Fox News in the morning show, and he's talking about how he thought that May is going to be a turnaround month, June should be getting back to normal, and July will be really rocking. That they have that they keep trying to sell this extremely optimistic vision of how the country is going to go, and I'm not sure that there's any advantage in that. I don't know who is giving them political advice, because what you want to do is you want to keep expectations low in a way, especially now, because you want to be able to say, well, you know, things look tough back in on May 1st, but we've made some progress. It's, yeah, it's July and things aren't back, but things are making progress. But if you say now things are going to really be rocking in July and we don't have baseball and it looks like schools might not be opening and there's no Lollapalooza and, you know, all this other stuff is going on, you look like a fool the way they're, and they're going to be playing that clip the way they're playing Trump's clips about how it's a miracle it's going to go away in a few days. That you want to set expectations in a reasonable fashion so that you can exceed them. And I just don't know why you do that now. The election is not till November.
Because you can keep sort of, this is the whole deal with the mixed messages and the cross messages here. I hate to sound so cynical, almost an excuse though. He can say, well, I didn't cancel Lollapalooza. They canceled Lollapalooza. And the state's in charge of this. And the cities are in charge of that. Numbers can be manipulated in a way that you can make yourself look good. I'm not saying that he's going to manipulate them, but...
Well, you're absolutely right. The strategy now, at first he said he had all the power. He was going to open up the states. He was going to take control of that. And then somebody got in his ear and said, don't do that. Just put this on the governors. And they are lifting as of Friday, they're lifting the 30 days to slow the spread. They're saying they're pulling that away, and Trump has just basically said this is up to the governors now. And so if everything goes well, he'll say, look, everything went well, I'm a great leader. If things go wrong, he can say, oh, those governors, they screwed it up.
Mm-hmm. There's two elements of it, right? There's a policy effect of a lockdown, and then there's like the fear element. We've talked about this in the last couple of weeks, you know, like people still aren't going to movie theaters in Sweden, even though they don't have a lockdown there. So maybe by being that optimistic, you're saying to people, you're not going to go outside and get coronavirus and die. Yeah, that's probably not likely. So it's more of a game being played with individuals rather than like a political game, because they need the economy to be doing well by the time of, for electoral purposes and in terms of just like the health of the country. So part of it might just be inspiring optimism, maybe in individuals to get outside and work. I don't know.
I suppose it depends on where your baseline is. You know, originally, if you want to start with Trump saying it's 15 and then it'll go to zero and in a miracle it's gone, then 58,000 looks like a very high number. But remember, some of those original estimates then came out and they said 1 million if we do nothing, 100,000 to 200,000. So Trump's always borrowing those big numbers. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're passing Vietnam deaths in 3 months here doesn't sound too high to the president, because look what he's done. He's kept us on. We should have never given him 100 or 200,000. That's the number, Lisa, that you talk about, a shifting set of statistics or narratives. They just keep throwing a different number out there.
It is. It's just sort of every day it feels like it changes. Okay. It's, you know, now we were looking at millions, you know, as it goes up. I mean, that was brought up, I think it was last, no, I know it was last week. You know, they were talking about millions could have died here, you know, and he does know to go back to the talking point of, you know, one death is too many.
Well, Kushner's already declared this a great success story.
Oh, yeah.
and the people are not really, the polls are showing that the people are not trusting what Trump has to say about the coronavirus. In the main, they're not happy with how he's handled it. So you've got a situation where the more people are talking about that issue, the less he's going to do, I think, in the fall. And he's already apparently looking at some really bad polling in some swing states right now. Now, all that's going to change. I think I agree with people who say that it's kind of too early to be looking at these polls too carefully. And so there's a long way to go. And a lot of things are going to happen. And we probably will, I certainly hope, we'll be out of this slide and we'll be on at least the downside of the curve by November. So we'll be talking about a lot of different issues rather than just this.
What was our first number? Was it April 7th? That was our get out of jail date, April 7th. Wasn't that the first one they threw at us?
Then it was Easter, which was April 12th.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Now it's going to be June 1st. Do you guys worry that we're yet going to get out too early, or do you think we're trending correctly on this stay-at-home order?
I think we're getting out too early myself. I think that we're probably going to be in for another couple of months before we can be confident. Unless some of these therapies prove to be effective or somehow they get a vaccine, which I think is really unlikely. But people, you know, I take a little poll on my site every week to see if people, when people feel like they're going to be confident going to theaters, going to arenas and so on. And most people are saying, like, not until there's some therapy or vaccine that I can be sure that I'm not going to die. Because the deaths from this disease are pretty ugly. And there are a lot of them.
Just to define all of this as sort of, okay, it's success and sort of we're in war and we're winning the war and all of those words. You know what? I hate that language. You know, people died. And for if you're a loved one who lost somebody at this time, you lost the battle. Your loved one lost the battle. It's hugely insensitive.
I see people going two directions on it too. I see us getting, you know, more and more terrified and more careful. But then I also see people at the same time getting just a little more reckless about it too. Yeah. I don't know if those are two populations or two versions of the same person, but it's kind of hard to stay as vigilant as I guess we're absolutely going to have to. I talked to one of these modelers from Argonne National Laboratory. I've talked to him a couple of times, actually. And, you know, his idea that we come out in June, we're still wearing face masks.
Mm.
You know, so the opening up of the economy is still socially distanced. So it really is, to your point, Eric, going to have to be a very gradual thing.
Well, the weather is going to be play an interesting factor for us because on the one hand, the really nice weather, the warmer weather is supposed to be good for the virus, right? It's supposed to kill the virus if it's warmer and lighter out. But it's going to bring people outdoors. It was kind of easy to stay inside in March when it was just kind of crappy out. But as it gets nicer and nicer, people are going to say, like, I really got to get out. I really got to go hiking. I really got to, you know, go to the park, play ball, kick the ball around, that kind of stuff. And it becomes harder and harder, especially as this is wearing on us. This is day 50 for me, probably for you too, Lisa. When was the last time you were in the office? 50 days ago,
sometime in.
Get up early and ride down Michigan Avenue. I come to work that way sometimes on my bicycle. Austin, you should join me. And there are more pedestrians and bicycles than there are automobiles or buses on Michigan Avenue. And drive home 7 a.m. 6:30. It's kind of fascinating, kind of fun, and then just so freaking weird, you know.
Yeah. I'll be there. I'll see you tomorrow.
You guys should both come in on unicycles. That would be so cool.
Those are the big items on my list, kids. Anything else that is jumping out at you this week?
Well, the whole accusation, the sexual assault allegations against Biden are pretty interesting, and I don't think they're easily dismissed, although some people want to dismiss them. I don't know if that's going to have any effect on any voters because you're left with a guy who has got one allegation against him against President Trump, who's got about two dozen allegations like that against him. So it may have people staying home. It may have the Democratic Party rethinking their nominee. I don't know. It seems like it's a big story and it's a little lost and all this other stuff, but it does strike me as one that's not going to go away.
He seems credible.
Is there good? No, I do wonder on that point. I do wonder whether his silence on this is what I think are in my conversations with people. That's what is really getting them. And so there are sort of two sides of the coin here, right? You just stay silent so that you don't have to explain something, or you just stay silent because if you have a misstep, if you deny it, you could find yourself in a place where you're painted as somebody who is, and the party doesn't want to be seen this way. You know, nobody does really, but you could be seen as saying like, oh, you're denying that this person, was a victim in an age where we are really encouraging people to come forward when, and to air this, when we're trying to get women to not be quiet, but to come forward and men too who have been victims of sexual assault. And so I think it's a real quandary. You know, does he say something, you know, and he's known for, you know, verbal missteps for sure. So I'm not sure.
What do you think, Austin?
Yeah, I think it's that allegation is as credible, if not more so than the Blasey Ford allegation with Kavanaugh, I think. And when that kind of people observe that kind of hypocrisy, I think, especially in the coverage of those two things, it's not good for any institution. We were talking about like trust and institutions earlier in the episode. Also in that filing under the do as I say, not as I do, this was sort of the last 2 days, Mark Conkle at the Patch was talking about where's J.B. Pritzker's wife.
Yeah.
And it's seemingly confirmed that she flew to Florida and she's been there, and Florida's obviously opening up. And I thought his response to that question was so tone deaf of saying, you know, it used to be, you know, you didn't bring in families to politics. And it's like, well, this is Illinois. Like, there's one person on average going to jail every week for public corruption. And a lot of it has to do with family members. Like, family members have a lot to do with Illinois politics, actually. And the distrust you're seeing from a lot of these downstate communities is, well, this billionaire's governor's wife got to fly private to Florida and she doesn't have to deal with any of this stuff. And yet I'm stuck not being able to go to the bookstore.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear his answer to that question, Austin. I missed that.
Yeah, he got ticked off about it. He was ticked off. He said, it used to be that, I'm not Austin, am I? Sorry, Austin, go ahead.
No, you probably know the quote better than me. I think it was something like, that's a ridiculous question.
Yeah.
You know, that's a ridiculous question. And the story was reprehensible that somebody would write something.
Really? I missed that too. JB said that?
Yeah. Yes.
Did he call it fake news? I mean, that's right out of...
No, he didn't call fake news, but he just said that he used to be the day when you wouldn't write it, that, you know, you didn't bring family members into this. It made me think about it, sort of where do you draw that line?
To circle back to Biden a little bit, there has been an imbalance in coverage, but there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that this coronavirus story is just dominating everything. So
totally. It's
been squeezed out. The other is that there was a certain urgency to the Kavanaugh thing, which is he was at the story with Blasey Ford was breaking during those hearings, and they were like, we got to figure this out. There's votes coming up. He's under oath, all this other stuff. You know, you say that Biden has not said anything about it. It's true, he hasn't. He's issued some statements,
right?
But he can't possibly get through the campaign without answering questions about this, a series of questions about this, and he better get his story straight. And my issue with Kavanaugh was not so much what he did in high school; it was that I'm pretty convinced that he lied under oath about a number of things. And I'm a little bit agnostic about whether he lied about Blasey Ford, but he certainly lied about all his other stuff in high school about the Renata alumnus and all that other stuff. He was lying comprehensively at that hearing. And I thought that was a disqualifying mistake, and that they should have swapped him in for somebody else. There are plenty of, judges who are approved by the Federalist Society who could have done that. But anyway, and I think at this point the Democratic Party is going to have to decide. You know, they kicked out Al Franken essentially for offenses that were allegations much less severe than this allegation. Now, of course, they were more recent, but this is a story I think that is going to remain important, going to be something that we're going to be talking about and thinking about through the summer. And you know, the nomination is not official until August. And it might be that the party's going to say, you know, we can find somebody better than Joe Biden to run against Donald Trump. And I was never a huge Biden guy. He was not my first choice. So I could really see them doing that. I would hope that they would think about it.
To put a button on the silence part, it's not only maddening that he's been silent about it. The point is he's been doing interviews and they didn't ask him about it. There weren't questions about it. That's what has been shocking to me. I mean, it's one thing if he gets asked a ton of questions about it and he's staying silent. It's another if he's going on CNN and they refuse to ask him the question.
Well, I sure hope that wasn't the caveat for the interviews, because every now and then we get asked not to ask a question like that about a something from a somebody, and our answer is almost always, well, then we can't do the interview, or at least we get to ask the question and you cannot answer it, but we can't ignore it. What if his answer is yes? I mean, people have already determined that Trump did that and worse. So I wonder how disqualifying it would be.
We're talking about something that allegedly happened. Was it in 1991?
Three.
Well, I have 27 years ago in my head, Eric, for some
reason. So 27 years ago. And you know, I think that, you know, if he says something like, you know, I did some things that I regret. I don't remember this specifically, but I can't deny it. You know, that kind of explanation might be able to get away with that. It was at 27 years ago, and then you've got to compare him to Donald Trump. But if he comes out and denies it, and then we get more people coming forward saying, yeah, she said something to me about it, or it becomes more plausible, then you've got an integrity question today.
It's kind of maddening, isn't it, or fantastic to think you have two Supreme Court justices who I believe lied about sexual assault or sexual harassment. You have a president who I think lied about that. You have a Democrat who might be the next president who credibly is charged with that and is afraid to talk about it. I don't know what to make of all of that.
Justin Amash is in the race, baby. No allegations. he's running against all of them. He's running as a libertarian. He's the first libertarian member of Congress.
Who does he take votes from, Austin?
I don't think that it's clear. So I saw, like, kind of on left Twitter, people being mad about it and saying he's kind of like the new Jill Stein. I think that's kind of, it's odd to me to think that a former Republican congressman from Michigan helps Trump by running in Michigan. You would think he would take votes at the very least away from Trump in Michigan. So I don't think it's clear at all who it helps. I think it certainly helps the Libertarian Party. My God. I mean, he's a fantastic, he was my favorite member of Congress before he announced for running, but he's extraordinarily competent, well-spoken, interesting personal story. He'll get millions of votes, I think, and will really raise the profile there. But I don't think it obviously helps Biden or Trump.
Last question, Eric. What's the interesting thing you're going to eat or drink this weekend?
Eat or drink this weekend? Probably nothing. In terms of interesting.
You are so beaten down. You have been in there so long. You're not getting out. You're not exercising enough.
I am exercising. I am on the treadmill a lot, but I'm not. We've been having family dinners, which is really nice. It's been a real change. We have everyone's at dinner at 7 o'clock every night. We're all together, which is
nice.
So that's special, but in terms of like special foods, I might want to make a special macaroni and cheese casserole, which doesn't sound very special, but trust me, when I make it, it's going to be great.
How about you, Mr. Berg?
I'm going to order just the spiciest Indian food that's available and try to just trip out, in my own home and try to hallucinate on spicy food.
It's your local pot shop closed.
Yep.
Well, I'm working on a new cocktail, but I don't have it perfected yet, but it involves Cointreau and gin. I'll let you guys know when I have it down to a science.
Very good.
In the meantime, thanks, Austin. Good to see you.
Good to see you guys.
Great to see you guys.
Steve Bertrand and Lisa Donovan had to exit to go do, I don't know, news or something. We are produced by Ashley Byhun and Aleph Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another Mincing Rascals pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.